Welcome to the GeoMob Podcast, where we discuss geo-innovation in any and all forms, whether for fun or profit.
Welcome to another GeoMob Podcast. I'm really excited about my guest today, Ian James. Ian joined the Ordnance Survey as a cartographic assistant at the age of 18, straight out of school or college, whatever it was in those days. And he's worked his whole life at Ordnance Survey, ending up as head of architecture and analysis. Ian wrote a massive blog post about his career progression at Ordnance Survey, which is linked in the show notes. But today, what I want to focus on is the evolution from traditional cartography with photographic plates and all of that stuff that used to go on in producing printed maps to the modern digital database that we call the National Geographic Database, and also to the open data products that so many of you are using. So, Ian, welcome to the GeoMob podcast. It's great to have you here.
Thank you very much for having me. Appreciate it.
Let's start by you explaining how you used to make maps from survey data and how that work got to become a printed map sheet, the old-fashioned stuff.
Okay, I'll put a bit of caveat around this whole section, is that it was 40-odd years ago and my memory is not as great as it was, so this is how I remember it anyway. So I wasn't a surveyor, and I didn't do large-scale mapping, actually, as a draftsman, so I never had that experience, but I did kind of do the training and stuff for it. But from my memory, the surveyors used to update what they called the master survey document. So this was basically a plastic sheet on which the large-scale map was held, and the surveyors would do hand-drawn updates onto that kind of plastic sheet as part of their sort of surveying practice. So the master copies of the data, as it's such in that term, were actually held in each of the survey offices. So it was effectively a distributed database, if you can think of it in those terms. Right. All the masters are out there. So the surveyors would do their survey, they do the updates, work out where change was happening, and those plastic sheets then got sent back to HQ. And the cartographer's job really was to kind of make that a tidy map. Because the surveyors obviously been doing stuff out in the field, they've been doing it outside. Our job was to take that, and they would do it periodically, send it in, say, actually, there's enough update on here to now publish a new sheet. They would send that in. The cartographer's job was to say, to make a presentable version of that map. That would include scribing by hand. So when I say scribing, basically that means that you had a negative image of the map, and you had a little kind of sort of blade, a scraper in effect, which you carved out of the plastic and created the map. So every time there was an update, there was effectively a new version of the sheet was kind of created in that way. That was then kind of printed, we'd annotate it, we'd put the text on it, and then the updated copy was then sent back out to the field, and that then formed the basis of the surveyor then doing updates for the next right. kind of edition. So it was that sort of cycle of updates that kind of worked.
Wow. So a bit like doing lino cuts.
It kind of is. Weirdly, I was away at the weekend at our printing workshop where we were doing lino cutting. It's something I actually fancy kind of doing a bit more of in my retirement.
Okay, but you're doing it with like a scalpel or something really fine to make those lines.
And different gauges for different types of features, so you might have different, yeah.
Okay, so I noted that you worked on generalization. And generalization is the essence of cartography, really, isn't it? You know, I mean, my friend Ken Field always says that cartography is about what you choose to leave out rather than what you include. So can you explain what you used to do and why it was so individual to each cartographer?
So The large-scale maps, they were either at a 1 to 1250 or 1 to 2500 scale. So that was the basis on which you created what I was initially working on, which is the 10,000 scale, which is where you actually did some generalization. So the what they did was they photo reduced the large scale maps down to actually to 1 to 5 thou scale. So you had, and they were then kind of sort of I guess kind of taped together into a kind of big kind of composite of the maps. And then basically you would draw with ink. You would draw on top of the those kind of photo reduced versions of the map, and you would actually then do the generalization process in ink by hand on top of those. So I mean, I guess there were a number of different generalization techniques that you were using that. So I mean, you're totally right. It was about what you leave out. It's not, that's really what the generalization map is. So you, things like simplification, where you kind of remove some of the details. So if there's a load of back fences, you would take out probably every third fence. You'll keep in, so you get rid of the rest. Things like aggregation, where you would take a bunch of houses that were kind of close together and you'd lump them together into one kind of block. You might sort of smooth out details, so rivers that have got lots of little kinds of kinks in them, you'd smooth that out to make it a bit more readable. And then the other thing, which was probably the more tricky bit, was kind of what we call displacement. So that's where, because you've made things a bit bigger to show them on the map, stuff starts kind of sort of buffering up, and you can't actually fit stuff in. So if you've got, particularly if you've got like a road and a railway and a river in a valley next to each other, you need to kind of move those things out, ease them out, and you've got to do it in such a way that you still get the general lie of the land, the general kind of how the world looks, and keep that together, but you make it into a kind of readable way. And then on top of that, you've got the annotation. So what do you choose to put labels against versus what do you not label against? Again, if you put too much on, it just becomes kind of unreadable. But there was a kind of a prescribed set of rules that you kind of work to. But every situation really required some personal judgment. So it was a set of rules. Yeah, there were rules, I guess. But you kind of had to use them as guidelines and then say, actually, in this situation, because every situation is different, how do I interpret that? And that's where I think the cartographer's kind of experience and skill kind of came in.
So if you looked at the 1 to 10K sheets that you worked on and compared them to the ones that the guy sitting next to you was working on, would you be able to notice some slight differences?
I think it's probably fair to say that yes. I mean, everybody had their own slight different ways of doing it. I can't say at the time it was a thing that we kind of particularly looked at, but I think it was certainly that there was a kind of QA department, and part of their job, I guess, was to look at, to make sure, I guess, to a certain extent, to remove some of the individuality, to say, right, make sure you're sticking by the rules, make sure you're kind of doing this kind of consistently. But yeah, everybody would have their slightly different way of doing it, slightly different way of putting text on, or kind of doing that sort of simplification and stuff. So yeah, it was, and I think there was definitely the thing when you got to much smaller scales where people, I think it is true, where people at cliffs and stuff like that, some of the cartographers were actually kind of etching their kind of sort of initials into the If you look close enough, you can actually see that. And some of that's probably still there, to be honest, because that's kind of come all the way through to the digital era.
Right. And so a 1 to 10K map sheet covers what kind of an area?
That would be 5K by 5K.
5K by 5K.
Yeah.
And was that one person working on that sheet?
From a drafting point of view, yeah, it will be one person seeing it through all the way through from beginning to kind of end. So from starting, it wasn't kind of part of my job to work out when a map needed updated. You kind of get told, right, this is the one that you kind of do it. But yeah, it would be the same draftsman seeing it all the way through. I mean, there are different people involved in various stages of it. So particularly on the reprographic side, where people are creating negatives and kind of doing enlargements, and so it would go through various stages in the process, and that was quite a long process. I remember the first map that I did, which I remember well, was the middle of Stoke-on-Trent. It was kind of post-industrialization. They were doing I think it was a garden festival. They kind of some of the and there was a lot of redevelopment there, and that map took about 18 months from me starting it to actually there being a printed copy. Wow. Actually being created. So it certainly wasn't real time.
No. And, I mean, compare that to the automated generation that they have now, which does, I guess, 95% of the work.
Yeah, I mean, the automation that we've got now at Tenthal, that is, by and large, I mean, you would get a pretty decent, totally automated process, would create a map that you could publish. There's some manual input just to kind of do a little bit of kind of sort of tidying up. But generally, yeah, I mean, that's just press of a button and you've got a map out of it.
Yeah.
Takes a little bit longer than that, but, yeah, but that's it. Yeah.
And if you're updating the NGD continuously virtually, you could be extracting a fresh 1 to 10K output once a year or something like that.
Yeah. I mean, the challenge with, I think, with generalization is that in theory, every little change that's made at a large scale could impact on the generalized map. We don't do that because it just ends up you doing a lot of processing for not a lot of effort. So it does tend to be more a periodic basis on which we kind of do the updates from an automated point of view. But I mean, those maps that I just talked about, it said it takes 18 months to kind of create. Those maps would be anywhere between, would be updated anywhere between 2 years and 40 years, depending on where it was. So if you were in the wilds of Scotland, those maps didn't get updated very often because not a lot changes.
No, but if you're in an urban area where there's quite a lot of development, then every couple of years.
Correct, yeah.
So we get to the end of the 80s or even the 70s, apparently, and digitization starts. And what were they doing and why were they doing it?
So I think initially the digitization program was primarily aimed at, I guess, operational efficiency. It was about creating a map quicker and cheaper. Really, that was kind of the main motivation behind it. So it was about making the end-to-end process from survey through to a printed kind of output quicker. And in particular, I think the process of updating the maps, because as ever, creating a data set or doing an initial survey is one thing. Doing the updates and keeping things up to date, that's a lot more hard work. So I think it was very much about doing that. The other interesting thing about it was, I mentioned earlier, whenever a new map came in, it basically got redrawn by the surveyor. And one of the risks there is that stuff just gets subtly moved every time. So the accuracy of the map can actually be impacted by the fact that you're redrawing the map every time. So again, having the digitization where actually you're updating the data and don't have to move all that stuff was one of the things. And interestingly, I think at the time, automation of generalization was one of the drivers as well. I think it was kind of a bit lower down in the pecking order, but it was definitely one of the drivers because, again, that whole process of creating a generalized map is quite manually intensive. It's interesting that I think it took a lot longer for that to actually be realized than the kind of process of automating the kind of creation of the maps themselves.
And I guess also, if we're going back to the late 70s and 80s, a large part of Ordnance Survey's revenues were coming from printed maps.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, effectively, we're a copyright business. I mean, it's about...
The big selling items were not the 1 to 1250, 1 to 2500 sheets, but the 1 to 10Ks and the 1 to 25Ks. And those all relied on generalization from the original survey data.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the 10,000 probably not so much. I mean, 25,000 definitely were the ones that, 50,000 were the ones that were probably the big revenue earners. It's interesting, the print runs when you did those kind of sort of 1250, 2500, 10,000, they were in sort of low double digits in terms of, so you put all this effort into creating a new map and the actual number of prints was probably about 20, 30, 40 copies were printed because actually the demand for them isn't high. But obviously the people that do use them, particularly kind of local authorities, kind of planning, utilities, all that stuff, have a heavy reliance on them. But it's a rare, very small number of customers who have a high value see a high value in those kind of those maps.
So when did data validation as a technical process start on this digital data? Initially, it was just digital spaghetti virtually, wasn't it?
It was, and it gets back to the fact that the primary motivation was to create a printed map. So as long as it looked good from a map point of view, as long as the lines looked okay, then that would be okay. But as increasingly there was a desire, both internally and from customers' point of view, to use the data as data rather than just a means to a printed map, that then kind of sort of drove a bit more focus on, well, actually the data's a bit rubbish in some places. And when I say kind of rubbish, what I mean was that actually particularly the data wasn't well structured. So where lines joined, when you print a map, well, that looks fine. The ink kind of makes it kind of look joined. But obviously, you know, with digital data, it needs to be very precise in terms of how stuff kind of sort of joins up. So there was that. And the other thing was that there were lots of different processes, lots of bits of software that were kind of updating maps, sending data various backs and forwards across various places. And all of those were kind of sort of written relatively independently. There was no kind of sort of off-the-shelf software we were using. So it was all kind of custom-built stuff. But all of those were doing slightly different things with the data. There was a spec, but it was kind of, as you know, with specs, they get interpreted in different ways. So what we kind of found was that the data wasn't consistent, and therefore when you took a bit of data that came out of one process and you loaded it into another, it didn't actually behave quite the way you expected. And even to the extent that actually, I mean, networks weren't as reliable then, you would actually kind of, when files were transferred across a network, sometimes it just got kind of cut short and you wouldn't know, so you'd lose the second half of the data or whatever. So the validation came in really because people wanted the data as data, we wanted the data as data, customers wanted the data as data, but we needed to be confident that the data was to a spec. And if we from OS wanted to do things with the data, enhance it, do automated generalization with it, we needed to know that the data was consistent and to spec, so that the processes that we developed downstream from that could reliably use the data. So we started to introduce a set of kind of sort of validations that would then make sure that whenever data was transferred from one place to another, that the output was correct to a standard specification. And then every process could then act reliably, knowing that the data it's receiving was to specification.
Just for, I mean, we've got a lot of people listening to this podcast, Ian, who probably, you know, haven't been in around this data for more than the last 10, 15 years. We're talking about a time when the data wasn't structured into polygons.
Correct. Yes.
If you had a house, it was four lines. If you had a road, it might be multiple segments. There was no formal structure that tied all of those segments together to make them an entity. They were just segments that joined each other or were close to joining each other, because the end point of one line and the end point of the line that it joined might actually be a pixel apart or something.
Yeah, that's right. And when I first got involved on the IT side, the area that I was kind of working was to put it very simply, trying to create coloured in maps. So previously it was just line work, and we wanted to kind of create maps that look kind of coloured in, had shading where the houses were or whatever. But you couldn't do that because the data wasn't structured in a way. So when you tried to kind of fill in a house, it would just bleed out across the whole map, and you just get this horrible mess of data. So it was the use that the data was needed to be put to, which wasn't the original purpose, was driving the need to improve the quality of the data as we went along.
And when I came into GI, which is quite a bit later, we were working with Landline, which was a better structured data set, but was still a spaghetti of lines, basically. And we had to write tools that polygonized Landline, and sort of, you know, you could click in the center of what looked like a polygon and actually turn it into a polygon and those sorts of things. So when did we start to get what we call a topographic database?
So I think the work that I was involved in late 80s, early 90s was a kind of, I guess, a trial to see what are the processes, what do we need to do data, how can we make this work to create a polygonized data set? And a lot of that was around structuring the data, tidying the data up, making sure it's more consistent to specification, it's well structured. We did that on, it was three very small areas across the country that we did it. That obviously proved to be a value to kind of customers, and there was then a kind of program, I think, which is OS 93, which was basically taking the data and doing and basically tidying the data up across the whole of the country, and that's where I think the landline data that you just referenced, I think, was used. The earlier product, that you could never have done that, you wouldn't have been able to create that, but we did all that tidying up so that we could actually be confident and customers could be confident that here was a well-structured data set and they could kind of do things. So that was kind of mid-day. And that was, I mean, that was a big program to go from doing three relatively small areas to doing that for the whole country and keeping it that way as well. So doing it as a one-off, tidying all the data up is fine, making sure that all the processes that are updating the data and keeping it current are also not screwing up the data along the way. We had to make sure that all that was happening. So it was a big effort just to go from, let's say, that sort of spaghetti data to something that was reliably kind of well-structured. But at that point, the product wasn't still polygonized. It was still just, it was well-structured line work, but that was all it was. It was line work at that point.
And then in the, when was MasterMap, which was?
So MasterMap, I think it was late 2000. I think it was late 2000, early 2001 when it got launched.
And that was the first sort of modern, what most of us would expect for a topographic database.
Yeah, I think that's right, and that was a big step from OS's point of view for a customer. But it would only be possible because of the smaller steps that we took all the way along the kind of road to get there. That was a polygonized data set. It was something that, in effect, you had what was close to kind of real-world entities. You had things that you could look at and say, that's a house, that's a fence, that's a garden, rather than this is just a bit of live work that, if you're lucky, you could work out that that's the edge of a building or that's the edge of a garden, something like that. So it was the first data set that OS kind of, from a topographic point of view, that you could say was kind of analytic ready. You couldn't do tons and tons of analysis with it, but it was definitely in a much better state for being able to do analysis on the data, not just print a map.
I mean, objects had some kind of classification, and a lot of the development that I've seen in the last 25 years has been about the extent to which the data has been classified more finely and more detail has been added. You know, and I mean, recently Ordnance Survey released roof data set, which is just about angles and areas of roofs and things like that. And
yeah.
That would have been inconceivable 20 years ago, wouldn't it?
Yeah, and the other thing that I haven't mentioned that made that possible as well is that consistency of identity of features as well. So it's not just actually that here's a building and we know that that's kind of well-structured and you can say that's a building. When you've got an update to the data, we could say that actually this is the same building and that building has maybe changed a little bit. So that sense of consistent identity, and that then becomes the hook on which you can then do that kind of attribution. That was a really important fundamental as well. So that kind of consistent life cycle of identity associated with features, again, was a kind of big step in terms of the data at that point.
So let's get to the late 2000s and open data, because we were on the same team but in completely different areas and didn't know each other at the time. So I mean, I was sort of working advising on open data and innovation and stuff like that, and you were involved in the technical production of the open data products. How easy was that? It was fast.
I would say it was fast. I mean, that, and that was the challenge, but also, I guess, the kind of sort of real kind of, I guess, one of the things that makes that open data kind of period actually really kind of quite satisfying. I think we probably had about 3 months from actually knowing that this was going to happen to actually getting the open data out the door. Now, what we didn't do at that point, the open data at that stage was just, it was existing products being made available effectively for free. That was kind of what was happening there. But from a technical point of view, so at that point, my role was within kind of architecture at that stage, and very much from an end-to-end architecture. So my role was about looking at how do we make sure that we can get those products, which are sat on the shelf somewhere in the Ordnance Survey building, how can we make sure that those are can be requested by customers, can be delivered by customers, can we make sure that whole end-to-end kind of process works? So it was about putting together the sort of systems and stuff that enable that to happen. Because we didn't have long, we just had to do, it was relatively straightforward because couldn't do anything kind of complex at that stage. It was just the products we had, so we didn't do an awful lot with the data. The data was what the data was at that stage. So technically, I think it was the challenge of the time frame, to be honest, that was the, but as ever with those things, when you've got that kind of challenge, decisions get made quick because they just have to. And decisions that would normally maybe take 6-9 months end up getting taken in a day. So it was great from that point of view to be able to do it. So I think the challenges, to be honest, from an OS point of view, were less around the technical stuff and more around the kind of the commercial and the licensing and all the other issues that kind of went with moving to open data at that stage.
But then you started to produce open data products, didn't you?
Correct. Yeah, and I think as I say, because of the time frames at that stage, all we could do was just ship the products that we had and say this product, where it was a commercial product that people paid for. Now that's kind of free. There's a bit of complication that actually people to pay for that over a 3-year period. So we had to try and work out how you kind of recompense them for what is now a free product. But yeah, that then kind of gave us an opportunity, I think, to sort of step back and say actually what is OS's kind of sort of approach to OS data? What data can we be putting out there as open data, almost as a kind of on a freemium kind of sort of basis to say actually here's some open data that kind of will work for you, but actually if you want to do more stuff, we've got some premium stuff over here that you can that could. So it was much more thinking about it in those terms rather than just, oh dear, we've got to get some data out, government's told us we've got to do this, let's kind of get it out the door. So it became a bit more of a sort out thing, which it wasn't at the first stage because it was a bit more reactive at that point.
And I guess that the all of the work that you and a lot of other people had done on generalization came to the fore in doing that, because you were taking premium products and generalizing them down to a level where they were useful as open data, but they weren't giving away the sort of premium value of the higher value commercial products that you still needed to sell.
That's right, but it's interesting that over the 10-15 years since we went to open data, I think initially the view was that what's really a value in that data is geometry. Is actually the positioning of the data. That's the thing that's really a value, and that's what we don't want to give away. So we won't give out the kind of very detailed kind of geometry. I think there's a bit of a shift kind of going on to say actually for a lot of people, particularly because you can get kind of very high resolution imagery, you can kind of do all that kind of automation stuff, you can get geometry relatively kind of sort of straightforwardly. Actually, what might be more a value is the attribution. So yeah, there's potentially a kind of shift from saying actually what's a value is geometry, and therefore what we preserve from a premium point of view is that detailed geometry, to actually make, well, actually maybe more it's the attribution on those features. It's like you mentioned, all that different building roof attribution, that's really the premium kind of thing. So I think there's a bit of a shift kind of going on with the OS in terms of actually what is the thing that we can make open and have a more measured premium thing, going from this is your open data, that works. If you go to a kind of the premium data, well, you can just kind of plug that on top rather than, I think, as it was certainly when we first did open data, they were almost two different data sets. Yeah. To switch from one to the other, the freemium thing didn't really kind of work too well because they were just totally different data sets.
And I guess also it occurred to me when you were talking about geometry not being the key selling point, OpenStreetMap in the last decade and a half, or two, well, it's 2 decades now, 20 years of OpenStreetMap. You know, 20 years ago, OpenStreetMap barely compared to a basic Ordnance Survey streetline or meridian data set or whatever it was, you know, the road center lines. Today, the geometry, I mean, it may not be surveyed to the same level of accuracy as Ordnance Survey's sort of National Geographic Database or something, but it's bloody good and probably good enough for most people. And as someone who's gone and surveyed the houses in my street, you know, and used one of the, not surveyed every house individually necessarily over, or drawn every house over imagery, but sort of drawn the block of houses between two streets and then said split that into 16 houses or 24 houses or whatever it is. And, you know, it knocks out 24 house boundaries, you know, for a terrace, for example. You know, that's good enough for lots of people.
Yeah, that's true, and I think it would be a bit strong to say it's existentialist, but I think there is a sense of actually what's the continued value that OSs provides for the future, given that there are things like OpenStreetMap, given the amount of kind of sort of satellite imagery or whatever else there is out there, all those other things are kind of crowding in. What is it that still makes kind of OS OS, and what is the real value that OS can kind of bring to play? And I think that's an ongoing discussion, I think, within OS. I think I wouldn't say there's a conclusion to that. I don't think the level will be. It'll be a continual changing thing. But I think it does. I think a lot of the assumptions maybe that have been made in the past 20, 30 years or so ago, some of those have definitely been challenged by developments from a data and a technology point of view that mean I think OS has to continually kind of reassess what is its value that it brings.
But I think, well, personally, I think having several hundred surveyors on the ground, all instructed to work from the same set of standards, is a material difference to having a community of individuals who decide what they want to capture, decide how they're going to attribute it, decide on all sorts of things, right? Whereas the OS surveyors, I mean, of course they must make mistakes occasionally, but largely, never?
No.
Okay, so the OS surveyors who never make a mistake, but they are governed by a set of rules and guidelines, which they largely are able to stick to, which gives you a sort of a consistency and a trust factor that is difficult to emulate, you know. And I'm not saying that OpenStreetMap's not amazing and accurate and everything. What I'm just saying is you cannot know that consistently across Glasgow, Ipswich and somewhere else, you know, in the same way that you would do with the Ordnance Surveys product.
Yeah, and I think about it in my head as it's... I think it's almost the non-functional characteristics of the data that are actually the more valuable. So the kind of currency of the data, the consistency of the data, that sort of standardization, that reliability around the data. I think those things, and those aren't, it's not that we capture houses, we capture roads, we capture this thing, we capture that thing. I think it's what OS kind of brings is that all of those kind of the more non-functional kind of characteristics of the data, which actually from a certain kind of bunch of customers is really important to them, that they actually have that, they can rely on the data, that they know that it can be kind of kept up to date, they know that it's to a standard specification, they know that when they look at the data and they interpret it a certain way, they can rely on the data to be correct. So I think that's kind of what OS kind of brings, and when you think about the kind of sort of future as well, it's kind of like, I think that's again, I guess that, almost that kind of gold seal that kind of OS kind of brings, be it our data or be it other people's data, and increasingly there'll be more third-party data and other data sources that we bring together. I think it's that OS really, I think, kind of sort of the benefit and I think the real value that OS brings to the data.
Okay, so as we sort of draw us to a close in this journey from scribing and etching negative plates all the way through to the National Geographic database. You're retired now, recently.
Yes.
Get out your crystal ball. And I don't want you to disclose corporate secrets that you weren't allowed to take away with you or breach national security or anything. But what do you think will be the product and technical changes in both our National Mapping Agency and national mapping agencies around the world over the next 20 years?
I think it's really hard, actually. I mean, more so than it probably was 20 years ago to kind of sort of look forward, I think, just because of the speed of change. But I think there's a few things. I think for me, I kind of alluded to it just earlier, that the increased integration of other data sources, I think particularly from across the public sector, but also from other areas, that there is so much data out there. We can't do everything. There's no point OS kind of doing anything or any other NMA doing anything. But what it can do, I think, is work as that kind of hub to bring that data together and to provide a much more joined up and integrated and richer kind of sort of view of the world. So I think that's definitely a thing for me. I think increased automation, clearly, being able to kind of with kind of AI and machine learning kind of techniques as well, the ability to be able to kind of capture stuff automatically, and that then impacts on things like currency, because if you do stuff automatically, then that's has that improvement. There's an interesting challenge there when you talk about automation, because what it does highlight is some, I guess, data accuracy, particularly for positional accuracy. So for instance, now when we're doing a lot of things automatically, we're kind of capturing stuff from imagery, we can work out where different types of land cover, different kind of buildings are, and that kind of stuff. What we find is actually that is so accurate, it doesn't actually fit with the features that we've actually surveyed, because they're not actually quite so accurate. So it becomes actually much more challenging than you would think to actually be able to integrate that in. So I think that's the thing. I think improved currency for customers is a thing. I think real time may be a bit challenging, and I think for a lot of our customers that's not totally necessary, but I think improved currency will continue to be a thing. People want the data more up to date. But more than the data almost is how people access the data and can use the data. So I think that's also a thing that, I mean, we've been sort of starting to look at, can we make our data available through other more standardized data platforms, things like sort of Snowflake and Databricks and stuff like that, and get our data out there, particularly when you're thinking about that data being consumed by individuals and organizations who aren't GI literate, don't want to be GI literate, they just want the value of GI data. So actually making the data much more friendly and usable within those data platforms, because that's where they go. They don't want to come to us, they want to go to where they actually do the data. And the positional accuracy thing, I think increasingly for some customers, knowing that when you've got very accurate positioning from GPS and everything else, and you suddenly realize that the map that ultimately has its roots back in maybe kind of 80, 100 years, the accuracy in certain areas is not quite where it's at, that's a challenge as well, because for a lot of customers, if we start moving that data, they're really not going to be very happy.
You did that once.
We did, and there are scars over a lot of people over that, yeah. The positional accuracy improvement program. So I don't think we'll be doing that, but it is a challenge, and we have some customers who are very happy with where it is, and some customers who definitely want it in a better place. So how we work that one out, I'm not sure, but it's definitely a challenge we're going to have to resolve.
Right, okay. So I'm not certain that I'm going to be around in 20 years to recap with you, Ian, but maybe there'll be somebody sitting in this seat still recording the GeoMob podcast, and they can touch base with you in 20 years and see how much of that has come true. Ian, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the podcast. Thank you very much for sharing that history and your experiences with us.
Thank you, Stephen. I've really enjoyed it, and I hope some people have got something from that.
Thanks a lot. Bye.
Cheers. Thank you. Bye.
Thanks for joining us today on the GeoMob podcast. We hope you enjoyed the discussion. You can get the show notes over on the website, which is at thegeomob.com. And while you're there, you can sign up for our monthly newsletter and find links to our accounts on Mastodon and LinkedIn, so that you can stay up to date on all our upcoming events. We hope to see you at an event soon.